This is Taking Aim with
Rob Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, September 30th, 2003. The Saudis deserve a very large part of the blame for September 11th. That provocative statement was made by former CIA Director James Woolsey, December 2001, in an interview in Salon magazine. The Saudis, he said, are a huge part of the problem. They have exported a lot of money to support an extreme form of Islamicist philosophy. The Saudis, setting up the Saudis. Not only former CIA Director James Woolsey, but Time magazine this September 15, 2003, in an article by Lisa Baya and Scott McLeod. Policymakers, they say, suggest that the U.S. invaded the wrong country and seized the wrong oil wells this spring. Last week, our Taking Aim program was setting up the Saudis. This week, we're discussing taking out the Saudis. In 1975, Henry Kissinger was quoted in a Newsweek article as stating that he warned that the U.S. might one day have to invade Saudi Arabia. Ralph?
This is not something that only emerged in 1975. As we've often cited from our book, Iraq and Kuwait, A History Suppressed, every United States administration since at least 1964 has prepared for direct seizure of Arab oil. And we've cited Robert Tucker in his important piece on behalf of the Pentagon in commentary in January 1975, Oil, the Issue of American Intervention, when he stated that without intervention, the United States would face a political disaster comparable to that of the 1930s. But in his discussions and in the Pentagon's review, the question of military intervention was treated as not a matter of if, but when. And they identified what was called a, quote, relatively restricted area, which, if controlled by us militarily, contains a sufficient portion of present world oil production and proven reserves to break the present price structure and to break the core of the cartel politically and economically. And it is this prospect that Tucker identified as the Arab shoreline of the Gulf, the new El Dorado, awaiting its conquistador, as he stated. And then he elaborated, the area that satisfies our essential requirements extends from Kuwait down along the coastal region to Qatar. This shallow coastal strip is less than 400 miles long and will provide 40% of OPEC production and 50% of the total reserves. It has no substantial centers of population. It is without trees. It is effective. Its effective military control will not bear even remote comparison with our experience in Vietnam. The theme, the plans, the delineation of something that was on a timetable was explicit from the 60s on. And we've cited as well the absolutely elaborated blueprint for Operation Desert Shield set forth in 1975 under the title Seizing Arab Oil by Edward Luttwak under the pseudonym Miles Ignotis, where they described the rapid deployment and strike scenario, the 82nd Airborne Division, the two air cavalry battalions, the C-5 and C-141 jet transports, the Israeli bases that would provide the locus for the paratrooper units that would be dropped on, quote, key Saudi oil fields, installations and airports, escorts provided by Phantom fighters based in Israeli bases aboard carriers in the Arabian Sea. And indeed, the Pentagon's plans, along with those of Henry Kissinger, even in his capacity as a non-governmental consultant in those years, addressed the question of the role of the Shah of Iran, who was assigned the task of seizing Saudi oil fields on behalf of the United States. Indeed, it was the Iranian Revolution which aborted those plans, which were quite well advanced. and indeed the London Times on Sunday Times on February 9, 1975, described what they stated was, quote, a United States National Security Council detailed plan, a top-secret Department of Defense operational plan to invade Saudi Arabian oil fields, the plan codenamed Dahran Option 4, drawn up by the Pentagon, providing for a United States attack on the oil field of Ghawar, which they stated would give us 40% of the world's known reserves. So elaborated was this that they had specified the specific units. It, quote, the attack will be led by 9 airborne infantry battalions based in North Carolina, flown under escort to Dahran in the Gulf through Israeli air bases at Hatzorim, and the battalions would seize the oil fields first at Dahran and then move inland to Ghawar, capturing the jetties and storage tanks at Ras Tanura, joined 3 days later by a specific expert Marine Division force, 14,000 men of special forces sent to the Gulf by sea. By August 75, oil fields as military objectives. The feasibility study was prepared jointly by Colonel John Collins, the senior specialist in national defense with 18 years experience in contingency planning in the Pentagon, and by Clyde Mark. The study was a minute analysis and documentation of the requirements for direct military intervention in Saudi oil fields. They had already elaborated the general geography, the spatial relationships, the topography, the water resources, the climate, the vegetation, the particular petroleum production plants that were to be seized first, the terminals, the control facilities, the lines of communication, sea, air, land, and LOCs involved within what was called the Saudi core and the critical terrain, the key wellheads, the choke points, the terminal facilities, the pumping installations, and the bases, with a detailed mapping of military, naval, and Air Force requirements, as well as the contingents necessary to restore and operate what was called the Saudi core. By August 25, 1977, President Carter had issued his secret presidential directive, PD-18, which called for the immediate strike force of several divisions for rapid intervention in the seizure of Saudi oil. Indeed, this total replacement of the Saudi monarchy and the Gulf rulers was a constant of each administration. Senator Henry Jackson, the chairperson of the Senate Committee on Energy and Natural Resources, prepared a secret report in December 1977, which called upon the United States to support the Shah of Iran in an invasion of Saudi Arabia as a prelude to American direct seizure.
What is at stake? A sea of sand and oil. As Time magazine notes, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia was proclaimed September 23, 1932. And soon afterward, the quest for oil began, with jockeying among the great powers. And with the advent of World War II and a meeting between Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Abdulaziz ibn Saud, the founder of modern Saudi Arabia, the United States became the hegemonic power in Saudi Arabia with the relationships of the U.S. oil companies. Saudi Arabia today remains the number one oil exporter and the leading supplier of crude oil to the United States. It has one quarter of the world's proven reserves. Petroleum accounts for 75% of the kingdom's revenue, 45% of its gross domestic product, and 90% of its export earnings. Oil, a sea of sand and oil, and U.S. designs for direct seizure of these oil resources, predominantly in the eastern provinces of Saudi Arabia. Black gold and barren land in the empty quarter. Ralph?
Maya, these plans were well known to the Saudis. I should mention here my own direct experience in these circumstances while I was director of the Bertrand Russell Peace Foundation, when in 1963 we had been approached by Gamal Abdel Nasser with a plan for normalizing relations with the Israelis on the basis of a Palestinian state in West Bank and Gaza with a corridor through the Negev, a plan about which we had considerable skepticism. Nonetheless, we went for the meetings with Nasser, and in the course of that we were asked by the Saudis to meet as well. And I met King Faisal in Riyadh in 1963, and I was astonished to find that the Saudis had a very much more far-reaching plan than merely to normalize the conflict with the Zionist state. Because from the perspective of the Saudis at that moment, the wave of Arab nationalism represented by Gamal Abdel Nasser in Egypt, by Abdul Karim Qasim in Iraq, by Atassi in Syria, and so on, was something that the Saudis felt they had to come to terms with. And indeed, the civil war in Yemen of that day, which was a surrogate war because the Marxist militants in the south of Yemen who were seeking to modernize that country were confronted by the feudal oligarchy in the north of Yemen, backed at the time by the Saudis. And King Faisal asked us specifically, the Russell Foundation, if we would undertake a negotiation with Nasser to reconcile that difference, because the Faisal monarchy was seeking to integrate itself with Arab national sentiment of the day. These discussions continued over a period of time, and I take note of the fact that when Kissinger went to see King Faisal, and he virtually gave a verbal dressing down to Faisal because of the U.S. concern about Saudi distancing itself from imperial plans in the region, Faisal said to one of his aides in Arabic, "Get this dog out of here." Within a short time, King Faisal was assassinated in Riyadh, and there was no doubt as to the nature of that particular event and the relationship of the Kissinger Central Intelligence Agency special squads to accomplish it.
Saudi Arabia supports our enemies and attacks our allies. That was the statement of Laurent Mirovich, a RAND Corporation analyst at the Defense Policy Board, July 10, 2002. He stated also Saudi Arabia was the kernel of evil, the prime mover, the most dangerous opponent in the Middle East. This set forth the recent attacks against Saudi Arabia, such as the Woolsey statement prior to that Saudi Arabia was key in the events of September 11th. In commentary, an article by Victor Davis Hansen, not an expert on international affairs, but a professor of classics at Cal State Fresno. And yet, Victor Davis Hansen wrote a very long article attacking Saudi Arabia. He mentions that in the past there was a devil's bargain, that's his term, devil's bargain with the kingdom, that was as utilitarian as it was unapologetic. They kept pumping the oil, either to us directly or as untraceable currents in the huge world pool. And we promised to ignore both the primeval nature of their domestic society and their virulent hatred of Israel. That is the quote of Hansen in this commentary article. Hansen sets the stage for an attack on Saudi Arabia, for displacement of the Saudi monarchy, for the direct seizure of the Saudi oil, or for ignoring the Saudis entirely and supporting the development of oil in the former Soviet Union with the stands, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and so forth, and agreements with Russia. Direct seizure and breaking what Hansen and the other neocons call the stranglehold of the Saudis. But what they prefer most of all is the breakup of Saudi Arabia and the direct seizure and control of the Saudi oil. Ralph?
Actually, Victor Davis Hansen may be a professor of classics, but like other professors of classics, he was his master's mouthpiece, because the Mossad plans for what he calls, and then, by the way, the title of this article is Our Enemies, the Saudis. The Mossad plan for this was elaborated in the 1970s in the Oded Yinon document, Strategy for Israel in the 1980s, which set forth the necessity to fragment each Arab country in its turn, and in particular, to separate Saudi Arabia from its eastern region and to have direct control over its oil. It is this strategic Mossad plan for which these mouthpieces sing the song. And the piece that you cite, Our Enemies the Saudis, does more than just give a description of the nature of the regime. It calls explicitly for the removal of the royal family and for direct military occupation. It is part of the overall design, orchestrated in the neocon precedent, though it may be, but presenting the Likud Mossad plans for U.S. imperialism itself.
Yes, Ralph, they are explicit, and the Hansen article is a key touchstone of the neocon statement of the direct attacks against Saudi Arabia. In it, Hansen states, quote, Saudi Arabia is the placenta of a frightening phenomena. Its money has financed native terror. Has financed it, meaning the attacks against the attacks on September 11th. Its native terrorists promote it. These are the statements. He talks about radical Islam. He says, after the murder of 3,000 Americans and the various anthrax, dirty bomb, and suicide attack scares, Americans are finally seeing militant Islam not merely as a different religion or even as a radical Jim Jones-like cult, but as a threat to our very existence.
This is not just the theme of the commentary writers. In fact, as we cited in our first part of this program, Setting Up the Saudis, there has been a constant series of such documents and such declarations. Fox News orchestrating the Rand Report, the Saudis are our enemies. They support our enemies, they attack our allies, and in this document, which was then replicated in the Defense Policy Board briefing on July 10th, it was a call for direct seizure, once again, of Saudi oil.
Another promoter of attacking the Saudis is Daniel Pipes. In his article, which was posted at mishnews.com January 9th, 2003, The Scandal of U.S.-Saudi Relations. And he quotes from the Washington Post of February 11th, 2002, about rich, quote, rich dividends that have been reaped by former officials. And this is why, according to Pipes, the United States has not taken out Saudi Arabia already. As he quotes, Americans who have worked with the Saudis in official capacities often remain connected to them when they leave public office. From former Presidents George Herbert Walker Bush, who has given speeches for cash in Saudi Arabia since leaving office, to many previous ambassadors and military officers stationed in the kingdom. In some cases, these connections have been lucrative. William Cutler, who served two tours as the U.S. ambassador in Saudi Arabia, now runs Meridian International Center in Washington, an organization that promotes international understanding through education and exchanges. And he goes on and he names various people from both the Clinton administration, the Bush administration, and the Carter administration, including Jimmy Carter himself, Clark Clifford, John Connolly, William Simon, and Spiro Agnew. So it goes back. And this, according to the neocons, such as Daniel Pipes, are the very reason that Saudi Arabia has not been taken out already.
By the Financial Times, as we've cited on the 21st of October of last year, the United States has taken the place of Saddam as the big threat to the Saudis. And King Abdullah was not shy about describing it. He stated, there's no talk about Israeli weapons. There's no talk about Israeli noncompliance with UN resolutions. This crisis is about the United States now waving a stick. After it is done with Iraq, it is going to force everyone in the region to bow to its demands. It will hit any country that opposes it. War is the first step towards a new U.S.-imposed order for this region. The breakup of Iraq and a puppet regime installed will lead to the breakup of other countries. The Saudis will be directly affected, so the Financial Times of that date. And indeed, William Crystal, as we've cited in the Weekly Standard, the coming Saudi showdown, the theme, again articulated in the Weekly Standard, seize the oil. It could happen soon, given Saudi truculence. Anyone preparing contingency plans to secure the Saudi oil fields will want to dust off their work. If Saudi Arabia cuts off oil exports or reduces them, we will not beg the United States to intervene. It will happen soon. That is, again, the leitmotif. Our enemy, the Saudis, repeated in commentary, the Defense Policy Board on August 6, 2002, orchestrated now in the Washington Post, briefing depicting Saudis as enemies, ultimatum urged to Pentagon Board.
Ralph, this has now found its way into the halls of Congress. As reported in the Associated Press on May 22, 2002, Representative Ben Gilman, the Republican from New York State, said, quote, Saudi money, official or not, is behind much of the Islamic extremist rhetoric and action in the world today. Already in Congress, they're setting the stage for an attack on Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia should be added to the axis of evil. That is what they're stating in the United States and also in Canada. Ralph?
Michael Ledeen singing the song. It is time to bring down the other terror masters. He is cited in the Washington Times of the 12th of April of this year. The spokesperson for the Conservative American Enterprise Institute wrote Monday in an article entitled Syria and Iran Must Get Their Turn and Saudi Arabia to Follow. And the Time cover story on the 15th of September of this year, seize the oil fields militarily. The time is now. And Richard Lugar in the Senate. The citation again from James Gordon Meek in the Daily News Washington Bureau orchestrated theme that the Saudis knew of the 9/11 plot. Yesterday, Senator Richard Lugar, the Republican of Indiana, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, stated, the Saudi royals are in cahoots with bin Laden, and they've been paid off by him. It is time to take action now. The International Herald Tribune, April 11th, 03, what country is next on the list? And there we have it, the Saudis. The Saudis have to be removed. Every one of these articles is a reflection of an orchestration of policy. As we cited in the National Post in Canada, Saudi Arabia is the country to go. The Saudi royals know that they'd be safer on their oily thrones. Instead of funding and condoning terror, if they stuck to their relatively benign expressions of stoning adulterers and amputating hands, and he concludes, the United States will remove them.
Taking out the Saudis, that is on the agenda. No longer setting up the Saudis, but moving to the direct policy of taking out the Saudis. In that vein, let's look at an article in the Los Angeles Times. Los Angeles Times, May 18th, 2003, by Saeed Aburish, the Saudi House of Cards, a grim economy and a grimmer political outlook. Aburish is the author of Saddam Hussein, the Politics of Revenge, and the Rise, Corruption, and Coming Fall of the House of Saud.
And he functions here, once again, as the mouthpiece and the exponent of the plans that we have described as being in place since the mid-70s, and indeed in the 60 arrange 1964 arrangements of Henry Scoop Jackson, the senator from Boeing, as he was called, from Washington, and the godfather of the neocons and the Likudniks, who are at the center of imperial policy today. What the article states in the Saudi House of Cards is that the Saudi royal family does not have the kingdom under its thumb as it once did. When the country's ailing 81-year-old ruler King Fahd dies, control will deteriorate rapidly, raising the question not only of what will happen to the House of Saud, but how America must react. Saudi Arabia's most striking problem is economic. Once flush with oil money, the West's most important Arab ally is now going bust in the face of lower oil prices. The government is unable to control its debt, which is top $100 billion.
Ralph, actually figures I've seen go as high as $200 billion, although $100 billion is the figure that's most often quoted.
And it cites the situation as follows. Average Saudis have been hit hard. In the early 80s, Saudi per capita income was $18,000 per year. Today it is $7,200. Jobs are so scarce that unemployment among new college graduates has surpassed 25%. Payments to construction companies working on government projects are a year late. This has led to sit-down strikes by workers in Jeddah, the eastern province, and elsewhere. The dire economic situation has energized opposition, including those embracing Islamic fundamentalism. But the United States has its own plans and does not intend to allow the situation to continue much longer. In the background is a royal family divided by internecine battles and an unwieldy succession process. Fahd's designated successor, Crown Prince Abdullah, a semi-literate 80-year-old in poor health, is too weak to solve the country's problems. He opposed the stationing of foreign troops in Saudi Arabia. He opposed the use of bases in his country to attack Iraq. In line after Abdullah is Defense Minister Prince Sultan, a man of 79, tainted by charges of bribery and his links to arms dealer Adnan Khashoggi. Indeed, conservative thinkers in Washington are calling for U.S. action now.
There's too much at stake, they say, and it is quoted by Aberish. There is too much at stake. Too much at stake for the House of Saud and the vast oil reserves to be left to the Saudi people. And what is the result? The result is that the Saudis are being fingered. Ralph.
Pressure on the regime will continue to build. Groups will gain strength. Opposition forces will accelerate their actions. And the article concludes, within the United States government, there is a push for intervention. For intervention now. The Los Angeles Times, the Saudi House of Cards, the culmination of this long series of propaganda exercises setting up the public for taking out the Saudis.
Taking out the Saudis. This is
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen coming to you on Tuesday, September 30th, 2003. On WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial and on the internet at www.wbai.org. Our first in this series, Setting Up the Saudis, can be heard on our website at www.takingaim.info. To continue, on May 12th, a Monday, Riyadh was awoken, shocked by a massive attack on various residential compounds. Just the beginning. Al-Qaeda's Grim Cat's Cradle is the headline of the report in Debka on May 18th. And they quote from President George W. Bush in a press conference on the White House South Lawn that he gave on Friday, May 16th. It's certainly a wake-up call to many that the war on terror continues, stated President Bush. And we've still got a big task to protect the American people and others who love freedom from the designs and the will of these purveyors of hate. But we'll find them, we'll bring them to justice. And he's asked, how will you deal with it? And his answer, the message is that the war on terror goes on, that there are killers on the loose, obviously killers on the loose inside of Saudi Arabia in this example. And 12 hours later, in Morocco, in Casablanca, there was another attack on a Jewish community center, a synagogue, a Jewish-owned restaurant, and a hotel patronized by Israeli visitors in the neighborhoods of the Spanish Cultural Center and the Belgian consulate. For many, this was confirmation of a string of Al-Qaeda attacks. But if we look at what really took place in Saudi Arabia, we see a different story. Ralph.
Maya, as we were indicating in the previous references, the story is very clear. A Salon interview by Asya Idemantaspas with James Woolsey was called The Midnight Ride of James Woolsey, with reference to Paul Revere. The Redcoats are coming, the Redcoats are coming, but indeed this theme of The Midnight Ride of James Woolsey is that the United States is coming to get the Saudis. Chaos in Saudi Arabia would be a far better option, he writes. And that is the context for George Galloway's revelation, as published in the Scottish press and then reported throughout the Middle East, an Anglo-American plan to break up Saudi Arabia and the Sudan through a series of disasters and chaotic developments in Saudi Arabia itself. James Woolsey, the exposers of George Galloway, are the real antecedent events and the context for the attacks in Saudi Arabia on the Vanel compound in May of 2003.
The Telegraph, May 16th, 2003. Bomber Moles in Saudi Forces, an article by Robin Jedeh and John Bradley, writing from Saudi Arabia. Quote, Al-Qaeda has infiltrated Saudi Arabia's military and security forces at the highest level, including those entrusted with the protection of Western residential compounds, American intelligence officials believe. They are convinced that the suicide bombers depended on a significant level of, quote, insider knowledge of the compounds that were hit, and that Al-Qaeda even infiltrated the elite National Guard, which is involved in compound security. Intelligence sources said several bombers were wearing National Guard uniforms to help them get into the three bombed complexes. The only area, they said, where there is evidence of a significant Al-Qaeda presence is in the Saudi Air Force, one intelligence official said. The police, army, navy, and National Guard have all been infiltrated. And we should note that the National Guard is trained by Vanel, once owned by Carlyle of former President George Herbert Walker Bush, and now owned by Northrop Grumman. American military and intelligence officers say the attack on the residential quarters of Vanel, whose ex-U.S. Army officers trained the National Guard, must have had detailed insider knowledge. And the Telegraph continues, it took 30 seconds to a minute to get from the gate to the housing block. They had to know where the switches were to operate the gates after attacking the guards, and they're quoting one military official. They then drove at breakneck speed with a bomb weighing nearly 200 kilograms to the most intensely populated location in the complex and blew it up. Now, they are attributing this to Al-Qaeda infiltrating Saudi Arabia's military and security forces. But if we look at the structure of Al-Qaeda, how it was formed and who funded it, the formation, a joint effort of the CIA and the Saudi royal family, we see that Al-Qaeda is a fake construct and that this infiltration and this action is actually a U.S. military Mossad operation.
This was translated very clearly by the press. The London Times on May 14th, in the shadow, Vanel is, quote, cover for the CIA. As befits the company that is the CIA's front for recruiting executive mercenaries and attempting to overthrow the Prime Minister of Commonwealth States, the Vanel Corporation had kept a low profile in Riyadh. Its discreet security fooled nobody, writes the London Times. The bomb attack was the second it has suffered in 8 years, each time relying on insider information. In response to this, the Vinnell Corporation, that has almost total control, as expressed by the writer Dan Briody in his author of The Iron Triangle, a study of Vinnell's relationship to the Carlyle Group, which was serialized in the London Times, there is no way that the operations that have taken place could have occurred without the collaboration of the trained personnel of Vinnell itself. A theme orchestrated in the Los Angeles Times: the bombings bring U.S. executive mercenaries into the light. The shrouded history of Vinnell raises the questions about its role in the privatization of U.S. foreign policy. The second time that Vinnell Saudi operations have been targeted, each time on the basis of insider information, the Los Angeles Times describes.
This is an article by William Hartung, who's a senior research fellow at the World Policy Institute, and it appeared in the Los Angeles Times May 16, 2003. The first attack on Vinnell Saudi operations were November 13, 1995, where it hit the Saudi Arabian National Guard, or SANG, with a 220-pound car bomb in an adjacent parking lot. Now, at that time, Vinnell was working with a major contract with the Saudis that dates back to 1975, when they were awarded a $77 million contract to train the National Guard. Now, the National Guard is a Praetorian Guard, protecting the Saudi royal family, and they're about Praetorian Guard. And there are 100,000 National Guards. They built up this force. By 1998, Vinnell was awarded an $831 million contract, a five-year contract. And this contract is run, not incidentally, by the U.S. Army Material Command. In other words, Vinnell's contract is supervised by the Pentagon. They have 1,000 employees, and in addition to the 1,000 Vinnell employees, there are 300 U.S. government personnel that are training the Royal Saudi Air Force and other Saudi military. In addition to Vinnell and the U.S. military, Boeing also has people in Saudi Arabia who are training the Saudi Air Force in the use of the AWACS that Saudi Arabia purchases from Boeing. We have here the hand-in-hand, the U.S. Pentagon and the Saudis, particularly through Vinnell, first owned by a private company set up in 1931 by A.S. Vinnell in Los Angeles, then under the control of Carlyle, and now under the humongous Pentagon military-industrial complex, Northrop Grumman.
Vinnell's job in Saudi Arabia, as described by William Hartung, was to prepare the National Guard, which Jane's Defense Weekly described as you say, Maya, the Praetorian Guard for the House of Saud, the royal family's defense of last resort against all internal opposition, unquote. The story of how an obscure American firm ended up by becoming the central part of the Saudi monarchy's hand-picked internal security force is a case study of how this company has become the central tool of U.S. foreign policy. And this is key, because this central tool of U.S. foreign policy, which had absolute and total security control in Saudi Arabia, is the very company whose internal codes, whose internal communication signals were in the hands of the putative attackers at the time of this event.
Vinnell, by the end of World War II, the company was funneling guns to Chiang Kai-shek in his attacks against China,
the revolution in China.
And in a memoir, CIA operative Wilbur Crane Evelyn describes that he was posted as a vice president of Vinnell as his cover while working in Africa and the Middle East in the 1960s for the CIA.
This is particularly evocative because Wilbur Crane Eveland is the author of the book Ropes of Sand, in which he reveals and documents how the Central Intelligence Agency station in Baghdad ran its asset Saddam Hussein in the assassination of Abdul Karim Qasim and the overthrow of the Iraqi revolution and the nationalist government of Abdul Karim Qasim in 1963. And that is the nature of the Vinnell operation as a proprietary organization of the Central Intelligence Agency with total security control over every facet of the monarchy's apparatus of military and intelligence security in that country.
And Vinnell, like DynCorp, operates as a mercenary group for the United States and also surrogate. They built military airfields in Okinawa, Taiwan, Thailand, South Vietnam, and Pakistan. And in Vietnam, Vinnell had 5,000 personnel. That's documented 5,000 personnel. They probably had more. So that in 1975, an article in the Village Voice, quoting an anonymous Pentagon source, said the company did everything from base construction to military operations. Mercenaries for hire, and they're quoted as saying, quote, our own little mercenary army in Vietnam.
Peter Arnett of the Associated Press interviewed one of the key Vinnell people in Riyadh, and he asked him if he regards himself and his colleagues as mercenaries. He stated, we train the people who pull the triggers. What we are is executive mercenaries.
Well, he may call himself an executive mercenary, but in 1979, when there was a rebellion that, according to this article, according to Hartung, rocked the Saudi regime and the opposition forces occupied the Grand Mosque at Mecca, Vinnell's so-called trainers were on the scene. They say coordinating the Saudi military response, but probably, as with the U.S. Special Forces, doing much more.
And in his article in the Asia Times, Maya, Ian Urbina, on the 22nd of September, Vinnell and the House of Saud discloses that not only was this operation attacking the central Vinnell control of security for the royal family, but it was done on the basis of inside knowledge and advanced knowledge, and that United States intelligence had the full detail of the pending attack prior to the event.
Now, we already quoted the statements that the people involved in the attack wore the National Guards. And the vehicles in which they drove had the units of the National Guards insignia. Now, eyewitnesses, according to DEPCA, said that they saw the people involved in the attack using actual keys to open up the sentry booths. Now, remember, these are very secure compounds, and they and these people involved in the attacks had the keys to operate the barriers and the gates from inside the security booths.
That is why the Newsweek article described how the plan had always been to take out the Saudis. March 20th, 2003, the Newsweek article that has been cited stated that Henry Kissinger had warned that the United States would indeed be invading to obtain control over the oil fields direct, and the first stage was to destabilize the monarchy and to prepare for its removal. The Vinnell attacks are the very implementation of this virtual multiple source announcement in almost every established medium of the ruling class of the plans long prepared.
That's right, Ralph. In the Los Angeles Times on May 18th, an article by David Kelly, U.S. provides new details about Saudi bombing plot. Assailants had cased the Riyadh sites and knew how to inflict the most damage, an official said. Now, the United States sent 60 FBI agents to comb through the wreckage of the three Saudi housing compounds. Excuse me. The U.S. officials, speaking on condition of anonymity, said the estimated 19 men who hit the Alhambra Oasis Village, the Jadawell Complex, and the Vanel Compound late Monday had cased the facilities for weeks or months and knew precisely how to gain entry and do the most damage. Quote, the guards at Vanel were Saudi National Guardsmen with 50 caliber machine guns. The attackers knew all the multiple controls at the gate. It wasn't like pushing a green button and the gate went up.
And this is why DEPCA, the Israeli intelligence service, designates it, as you have been saying, Maya, as an inside job. Because, quote, eyewitnesses saw those clearly in command positions using their keys to open up the sentry booths, and that others had keys ready to operate the barriers and gates from inside those booths. These are command positions of Vanel, command positions of the Central Intelligence Agency, operation of the National Guard units protecting the Saudi royal family, who are opening the barriers, providing the secret codes for attackers on the compound.
Now let's look at some of the people who were killed in these attacks. The workers at Vanel, who we mentioned train the Saudi National Guard. The Saudi National Guard is headed by Crown Prince Abdullah. And nearly all the residents of the Jadawell are contractors for the Saudi Air Force, run by Prince Sultan Ibn Abdul Aziz, a brother of King Fahd. One of the owners of the Alhambra is the deputy governor of Riyadh, and his son was killed in the attack. Now, he is closely associated with Prince Salman ibn Abdulaziz, who was another brother of King Fahd. In other words, this was a direct attack on the Saudi royal family. According to a U.S. official, quote, this was Pearl Harbor for the House of Saud. I think we're going to see more attacks on this regime. It wasn't a subtle message.
And that theme has been amplified in the Daily Telegraph in London on May 16th of 2003. American military and intelligence officers acknowledge that those who carried out this attack had detailed insider knowledge. It took them 30 seconds to a minute to get inside the housing block. They knew where the switches were to operate all the gates. They drove at great speed with bombs weighing nearly 200 kilograms to the most intensely populated location in the complex. No one stood in their path. None of the units in place to intercept and to attack any such intrusion were in evidence. A specialist of the Jamal Jarudi S, the Riyadh security firm, which provides security for 150 compounds, told the Telegraph that all security was inoperative at the time of the attack. Bomber moles in Saudi forces, Robin Gaday and John Bradley in Jeddah, the Daily Telegraph, an inside job.
An inside job to destabilize the Saudi regime. And article after article, policymaker after policymaker, putting forward that the time is ripe for an invasion of Saudi Arabia. What is the reaction of other members of the ruling class? The ruling class is not unified in the position on Saudi Arabia. Anthony Kordsman from the Center for Strategic Studies in Washington on May 15, 2003, published an article in the Financial Times, Do Not Abandon Saudi Arabia. He says, since September 11, 2001, quote, there has been an increasing tendency to treat Saudi Arabia, not Mr. bin Laden, as the enemy. The result has been a flood of criticism of the Saudi leadership, Saudi social practices, and the Saudi interpretation of Islam. Ralph?
This is a split that has to do with a strong element in the class, basically Eastern finance capital, that looks upon the Likud design for fragmenting each Arab country in its turn for preventive war as reckless endangerment of imperial interests. From the perspective of this sector of the class, the pass-through elements, the country-selling regimes, are indispensable to maintain a semblance of stability in the region. And nowhere was this perspective more clearly set forth than by retired General Anthony Zinni, who was the nominal Bush factotum in the Middle East in the arrangements to remove the Palestinian Authority from any semblance of existence in the West Bank. Nonetheless, Zinni, the former commander of the U.S. Central Command, was interviewed by Ted Koppel on Nightline, and his remarks were rather astonishing, because Zinni compared, quote, Bush's push for war with the Gulf of Tonkin incident, an infamous episode in which President Lyndon Johnson misrepresented an attack on two U.S. Navy destroyers in order to maneuver congressional approval of the war in Vietnam. And as to the characterization of those around Bush and that wing of the class that is centered now in the Defense Policy Board, in the Project for a New American Century of the American Enterprise Institute, the neocons, the Wolfowitzes, the Pearls, the Rumsfelds, Zinni, as David Korn cited in The Nation, is extremely clear. We are in danger of failing because this Bush administration has not readied itself for what will follow the military engagements. We fought one idiot here. Ohio State beat Slippery Rock 62-0. No shit. You know, we weren't ready for that team that came on the field at the end of a three-week victory. Right now, we're dealing with jihadists that are raising hell. We have no control. There's instability. There's chaos. I just got back from Jordan. We are scared of what is being planned here. Resources are needed. A strategy is needed. This is a different kind of conflict. These people have no idea of what they are doing. I spent the last 15 years of my life in this part of the world, and I'll tell you, every time I hear one of these dilettantes speak out of about this region, they don't have a clue. They don't understand what makes it tick. They don't understand where they are in their own history. They don't understand our role. They don't understand the tactical problems. They are lousy at solving the strategic problems. They haven't got a strategic plan. They don't understand the region or global security. They don't know what it takes to weld this, to shape it, to move it forward in our interests. It can't be because some policy wonk there has a brain fart of an idea of a strategy that isn't thought out that we put our enlisted men and women in harm's way. Brain fart. The characterization of the strategic plans of the Bush administration by Zinni, a reflection of the fact that a sector of the class is indeed engaging in that passing of wind as it contemplates the consequences of destabilizing the entire region, of taking out the Saudis, of creating an absolute cauldron of resistance from every corner of the world to the design of permanent war, a preemptive war for the 9/11 event that was the predicate for the unfolding of this policy. Taking out the Saudis is the design of this administration and the sector of the class with the Mossad and the Israelis that pushes it forward. There is another sector of this class that is contemplating the fatal consequences. But they are damned if they do, and they are damned if they don't.
Ralph, this is revealed in the Telegraph from Great Britain, Tuesday, 20th of August, 2002, more than a year ago. They note in this article by Simon English, Saudi investors have $750 billion in the United States. Now, this is an estimate because it is probably more. And Simon English says, quote, a mass walkout would seriously impede the U.S.'s attempts to pull away from the recession. According to government figures, foreigners put $124 billion into the U.S. last year, that's in 2001, and this is down from $301 billion from 2000. That's $200 billion less. As Kortzman had said in his piece, Saudi Arabia is an important trading partner of Europe, Japan, and the United States. It exports $78 billion worth of goods a year, depending on petroleum prices, and imports $30 billion a year. Equally important, the government and its private citizens invest in the U.S. and Europe, and the total is in excess of $500 billion in spite of the repatriation of capital since 2001. Now, we're not talking about pennies here. We're talking about huge impact on the U.S. and European economies.
Listen to David Corn in The Nation with respect to Zinni. Brain fart? That's not quite a military term, but these are fighting words. And Zinni practically counseled his military audience to rebel against the Bush administration. U.S. troops should never be put on a battlefield without a strategic plan. Not only for the fighting, our generals take care of that, but for the aftermath. Where are we? Where is the American people? If we accept this, if we accept this level of sacrifice, if we accept this absence of planning, everyone in this room, our feelings and our sensitivities were forged on the battlefields of Vietnam. When we heard the garbage, when we heard the lies, and when we saw the sacrifice, and we swore never again would we do that. We swore never again would we allow it to happen. And I ask you, it is happening again? Are you going to have to answer that question just like the American people are? That is the Zinni quotation, an American general. And if the generals in a sector of this class are sounding the alarm about this policy, sounding the alarm about the pretext for this policy, is the expose of 9/11 far behind? For 2 years, we have been sounding our own alarm about the hands of intelligence, about the false flag operation, about the meaning of the 9/11 treason at the top. It is time to mobilize. It is time to seize the moment and to build that mass movement that will send these people into the dustbin of history where this criminal class belongs.
You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Taking Out the Saudis. You can hear it again on our archive, www.takingaim.info. You can contact us directly, and we'd love to hear from you at 212-209-2953 or at 707-552-9995. Our email address is takingaim@pacbell.net. That's PACBELL.net. We'll be with you next week. I'm not afraid to die.